Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's call is being recorded. Later, there will be a question and answer session, and instructions will be provided at that time. After you have signaled, you will be asked to record your name. This will be played into the conference, indicating your line is open to ask your question. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Kate Harner. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling in to Cigna's Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call today, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you'll be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After the survey, you will have a chance to ask questions about today's seminar. Due to some technical difficulties, we are having some trouble with our eating disorder website today, but I will give you some instructions on how to access the seminar materials if you're able to go through the website. It's available online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side of the screen, you want to click the link that says Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Then click the link that says Eating Disorder Education and Resources. And finally, click where it says Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of that screen by today's date, you'll find today's handout. Again, visit us online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side, click the link that says Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Then click where it says Eating Disorder Education and Resources. And finally, click on Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen by today's date, you'll see today's handout. And after today's session is recorded, you'll also see a link there for the recording. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Denise Steyer. Dr. Steyer is the clinical director of the PHP and IOP at Alexian Brothers Center for Eating Disorders, as well as Alexian Brothers Center for Self-Injury. Today, she'll be sharing information with us on eating disorders and self-injury. Welcome, Dr. Steyer.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here and be part of your eating disorder series. And it's very odd for me not to be able to see the people that are participating. So this is a new experience. I'm really excited to be talking to you both about the eating disorders and self-injury. They are both passions of mine of working with these individuals and their families. And I think it's great that we're starting to recognize that both the eating disorders and the self-injury do oftentimes occur together. I have a picture here that has a young girl rolled up in a ball that has feeling words aside, and then I have another picture with it's actually a razor blade, I don't know if you can tell, with different words. And these are a lot of the words and the feelings that those that we work with say that they experience. And oftentimes for the family members and the loved ones, they're very surprised to see that their child or their significant other might experience some of these feelings and really sad thoughts. So why do we want to focus on eating disorders and self-injury? Well, one of the things that is really important to know, and many people aren't aware of it, is that eating disorders have the highest rate for mortality out of any illness, any mental illness. We have the highest death rate. And oftentimes, we're not considered a serious mental illness, but we are. A lot of people still want to say, well, just eat, or well, what's the problem with being really thin? And we have a society right now that's really obsessed with thinness, and that oftentimes causes some struggles for our individuals. But eating disorders have the highest rate of mortality rate, and out of that, they're a high suicide risk. So they're not necessarily dying from the eating disorder. They're dying from the depression that can go along with it and that hopelessness and helplessness feeling of the suicidal thoughts they may experience. Also, self-injury is a high suicide risk due to the impulsiveness and due to some of the self-injurious behaviors that individuals might engage in. I think a very important thing to be aware of with eating disorders is that very rarely can we tell that someone has an eating disorder just by looking at them. I've heard of some people putting their fingers around someone's wrist to see if there's an overlap. And if it's not far enough, then they're not too skinny and they don't have an eating disorder. That is a myth. That doesn't work. We've also had people say, well, they look, you know, normal weight, so they can't have an eating disorder, or they're really heavy, or they're really thin. Eating disorders by nature usually the individual usually has a normal weight. Someone who's very emaciated, very thin, very sickly, might be struggling with a severe case of anorexia. Somebody who has binge eating disorder may be struggling with obesity, but we have all shapes and sizes. So just by looking at someone, you cannot tell, oh, yes, they have an eating disorder. So exactly what is an eating disorder? It's usually a good sign that there is a problem. And it's usually related to self-esteem, being able to manage one's feelings. Whether we look at feelings as if they're all the same feelings. They're no good, no bad feelings. Many of the individuals I work with and some of the families view feelings as good feelings and bad feelings. So it's the regulation of the feeling. It's the being able to manage the anxiety, the disappointment, the sadness. Sometimes it's being able to manage those good feelings. Oftentimes feeling helpless or out of control. Oftentimes accompany these feelings. You'll see a range of eating. We'll see people who have normal eating patterns where if you watch what they ate, you'd be surprised to find out they might have an eating disorder. Those that engage in occasional dieting, a lot of frequent eating, a lot of compulsive overeating, and bulimia to anorexia. So I'll explain what those all are in a little bit. Also, our individuals struggle with some values of theirs. They have some thoughts around acceptance. Oftentimes they don't feel that they're accepted. Being who they are is not good enough. Their self-worth is pretty low, or they view what other people's feedback, comments, or for some of our teens, their grades, or the college students, where their grades are, how many AP classes they have, determines their self-worth. Of course, their safety, whether it's safety for their thought process or medically. Fear, there's a lot of fear of not living up to other people's expectations, not living up to their own expectations, not being good enough, being out of control. Many of our individuals do not report feeling attractive and that they're just not quite good enough, no matter what they do. For those who struggle with the self-injury, oftentimes I kind of put them in four categories, and the eating disorder individuals will fit in these as well. They have intelligence. And for many, what I see oftentimes for people struggling with eating disorders, they work hard for those good grades. They pride themselves on the good grades. And sometimes those who struggle with the self-injury, they're very smart, but their grades do not often reflect that. Another area is that both groups are very creative. And I can't wait to see who will make it big, who will be able to be successful in their creativity between the writing, the music, the drama, the poems, the drawing. It's just amazing to see how artistic these individuals are. The other one is that these individuals tend to be super sensitive, more of a hyper super sensitive. And I'll tease and I'll take a joke that, you know what, we line people up in a row, and if I make a joke, they're the ones who'll be mad at me for picking on the chicken, for just trying to cross the road. They kind of go for that underdog. Oftentimes they view themselves as the underdog. And what I frequently hear family members state is, you know what, I said the same thing to the other two and children, and they never had an issue. Our individuals, they're a little bit more sensitive. Things bother them a little bit more than what the average person might be feeling. And then the last one that I feel that fits them very well is that these guys have hearts of gold. And by the time they come into a hospital for hospital care, there may be some discord with them and their family, so the family members might not see it. So if I change it to hearts of gold for their friends, definitely that people will see that. These guys will do anything and everything for anybody, and they put themselves on the importance of the world as being last on that list. And they're so worried about being conceited or full of themselves, and we sit there and we talk to them and explain that you're so far from that. It'll take us a long time for you to get to that point of being conceited. So when you look at these different traits of an individual, you think, wow, those are really great traits. Why wouldn't you want someone to have them? We do, but we're kind of balanced and we're skewed off. We're not in a balanced situation where we're able to care for others but put our needs there too and be able to recognize that someone may be kidding with us and not taking it super sensitively. So we work on that balance. We work on them learning, hopefully, to start to view themselves in a little different way so that they do get their personal needs met. So I have included quite a few slides in here about what the DSM is. And if you're not familiar, the DSM is called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. And it is a book where we have every kind of diagnosis out there. And it's what we use for our guidelines and criteria in diagnosing individuals. They're going through a lot of changes with the DSM. Right now we're on the DSM-4 version, and they're working on coming out with a DSM-5, hopefully in the spring. And what they're going to work on is making some changes. When the criteria came out, it was expected that majority of the individuals would be with eating disorders would have an anorexia nervosa or a bulimia nervosa criteria, with very few fitting in under the eating disorder NOS. What we have found out is that the criteria is quite stringent and limiting. So most of our individuals have an eating disorder NOS diagnosis. NOS stands for not otherwise specified. So they're working on making some changes to hopefully have that be more balanced. And so you know, anorexia nervosa is where there's a significant low body weight in relation to the individual's age, gender, and development. So the significantly low body weight right now is considered anything under 85% of where their body weight should be. And they're going to make some changes on that. But this is more for, the slides here are more for resource information for you. Also, for anorexia nervosa, there tends to be an intense fear of gaining weight or becoming fat. Right? So even those that are at a significantly low weight might struggle with those thought processes and those fears. Currently, for anorexia nervosa, they indicate that a woman has lost her period for a number of months. This has led to some disbelief, some myths that boys cannot have anorexia because they don't have their period. Boys do get anorexia, and we're seeing more and more males actually have eating disorders and are coming in for treatment now than ever before. So it's not just our female population, but it is across the board. We do primarily have females with eating disorders, but more and more boys are seeking treatment. Then there are two types of anorexia nervosa, and these can be somewhat confusing. The first type is the restricting type, where there's no binge eating or purging behavior. Binge eating means eating a substantial amount of food in a short amount of time, more than one would normally eat. An extreme example of a binge might be eating a box of Oreos followed by 2 gallons of ice cream followed by a bag of pretzels. Purging behavior would be to eliminate what you just ate, such as self-induced vomiting, laxatives, diuretics, enemas, or maybe a 4 or 5 hour exercise period. The other subtype of anorexia is binge eating / purging type. And that is when a person is engaged in recurrent episodes of binge eating and purging, but restricting is their primary mode of controlling and managing their weight and their thoughts. The next eating disorder that's very common is called bulimia nervosa. And bulimia nervosa is when an individual eats food and then gets rid of it. Purging behaviors such as the vomiting, the exercising, the laxatives, the diuretics. There's a strong belief that if I get rid of the food, then I won't gain the weight and I can actually lose weight. Some of the things that we do, and oftentimes we work with our families as well, is to work at home on not having the individual go to the bathroom for maybe 45 minutes after one eats. That way you can make sure that the food has been absorbed and digested within the system. Of course, I don't want you tackling them. If they're insistent in going, then work with them. If they're refusing, then we want to come back later to therapy and talk about what happened. But we do work on that here in the hospital as well, that we work on not having any bathroom breaks after we eat or after snacks, because we want the individual to work on keeping the food in their system so they can get that nourishment that their body so desperately needs. there's two subtypes of bulimia, and one is the purging type, where the current episode of bulimia, the person regularly engages in vomiting or misuse of laxatives. And then the non-purging type, which is that the individual does not do anything to rid themselves of the food. And they're proposing that we have a new diagnosis come out called binge eating disorder. A lot of people think of it as comfort eating, emotional eating, where you eat a large amount of food and then you do not purge, you do not get rid of it. And we're seeing more and more individuals coming in struggling with the binge eating disorder and using food as a substitute and a way to manage their thoughts and feelings. Usually with the binge eating disorder, there's a sense of a lack of control over eating, cannot control how much one's eating or cannot control when to stop eating. So there's that out of control feeling that's going on. The binge eating episodes usually, the person usually eats until feeling uncomfortably full. Kind of think Thanksgiving, but throughout the year, not just on that one occasion. Eating large amounts of food when not hungry. Eating alone because you're embarrassed to eat around others. Or there's usually a lot of disgust and depression and guilt after eating. For binge eating, it cannot be associated with the other eating disorders. And then we have eating disorder NOS, which is anything that doesn't fit. So if someone right now isn't binging as frequently as what the criteria says, it'd be eating disorder NOS. So it's still indicating there's an eating disorder, and just because it doesn't meet the bulimia criteria, it does not mean that it's still not a serious illness and a serious issue. Okay, I've skipped ahead to slide number 21, just so if you want to keep track with me. I'm at NSSI. I just want to give you a brief background with that as well. NSSI stands for non-suicidal self-injury. And many of us call it self-injury, self-harm, deliberate self-harm. A term used to be used quite frequently with self-mutilation. Excuse me. That terminology is really not being used that much anymore. But there's a group of researchers who have been in the field probably about 8 years. They come from a variety of different universities. We have some from University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. We have them from Cornell and Harvard and British Columbia. And what they're looking at is realizing they were seeing more and more individuals on their college campuses that were engaging in the cutting behaviors. And they've got together and they're talking about different ways. And is this an alarm? And is this something we need to be aware of? We here at Alexian think this is great since we've been working with self-injury for 11 years now and really have never had a lot of research or data or information. So we're kind of joined with these researchers and formed a group called the International Society for the Study of Self-Injury. So it's worldwide. And we're talking about what's going on in different countries and why this is occurring and is what do we need to do to understand and help our individuals who are hurting themselves on purpose. So a definition was put together by the International Society for the Study of Self-Injury, and it's called non-suicidal self-injury is deliberate self-inflicted destruction of body tissue without suicidal intent and for purposes not socially sanctioned. Now, as we look at that definition, for me personally, what I do in our program is I do look at areas that might be socially sanctioned, such as tattoos and piercings. And I always ask, what is the function and purpose of a behavior? Why would someone purposely hurt themselves? And for some individuals, the tattoos and piercings are just another way to show for themselves their own unique individuality. For some, they believe it's artwork. Some love how it looks. Others are doing it as a way to hurt themselves. Because when you injure and when you have a piercing or a tattoo, you can get that same emotional reaction. I'll touch base on that in a little bit. And so I want to clump that in together, even though our definition does not state that. For many of the teens and the young college students I work with, sometimes the piercing and tattoos are an issue. Non-suicidal self-injury is distinguished from suicidal behaviors involving an intent to die, drug overdoses, and then here we have more about the piercings and tattoos. I have worked with individuals who have told me that they did do that drug overdose as a way to hurt themselves. They didn't want to die. So I do look at that again, the purpose and function of why they're doing their behavior. Non-suicidal self-injury is a high suicide risk because it can be scary, it can be lethal. If an individual is using drugs and alcohol and cutting, oftentimes they're not aware of the damage they're doing to their body. So we want to make sure that they're understanding what they're doing and making sure that they're safe. I put in here the criteria for what the DSM would be stating. It'd be 5 or more days of self-injury in the past year. It could not just be because someone had a body piercing or a tattoo. It would not be picking at a wound or nail biting or ripping a hangnail. So it wouldn't be that trivial in nature. It would be associated with depression, anxiety, tension, anger. A lot of those who report injuring hurt themselves as a way to express themselves. They oftentimes state that the feelings inside are so overwhelming they don't know what to do. They feel like they're going to explode. So by purposely hurting themselves, a couple of things are happening. One, if I hurt myself and can tolerate it, then no matter what anybody else does to hurt me, whether physically or emotionally, it won't matter as much because I can handle my own pain that I put on myself. They also report that they don't know what's going on internally. They don't know how to handle those emotional feelings. So by hurting themselves, and I'm going to use cutties as the example, I know how to handle physical pain. I don't know how to handle emotional pain. So I know how to take care of that, put a band-aid on if I want, or not to take care of the wound if I want. So those are some of the things that we hear oftentimes here of why someone would purposely hurt themselves. It's a way to manage. It's a way to cope. And when you think about coping skills, oftentimes hurting oneself is not on that list. It's a creative way. It's a quick release, but it's not helpful in the long run. And if treatment hasn't happened or it isn't addressed, then over time the injury will increase more frequently and more severely. Right, so that's always something to keep in mind. What I'm oftentimes hearing some people say is it's just common, normal adolescent development. I did it as a teen. It's not normal adolescent development. It is an indication that something isn't right and that your loved one is struggling and doesn't know how to cope and doesn't know how to handle with what's going on. Okay. So I'm going to move that. So why do we not call them cutters? It's derogatory and it's pejorative. It labels them as their behavior instead of who they are. And also many people do more than just cutting. I have a list here, and I do have hair pulling, which is also considered an anxiety disorder. It can fall under trichotillomania. So we oftentimes assess to see if they're using it as a way to hurt themselves or if they're using it as a way of anxiety. But here's a list of what we have come up with, what we see most frequently and most common for self-injury. And I've also included tools, and this can be quite overwhelming to see all this long list of tools. The thing that I think most people find very difficult in working with the self-injury and having someone that they care about hurt themselves on purpose is that there's not anything anyone can do to make them stop. These individuals, it's their choice. Initially, they don't understand because they don't know how to handle it. They don't have other coping skills. But as they learn how to manage what's going on and how to increase their coping skills in a healthy way, they do get to make that choice. So we can lock up anything that's considered a sharp object or hurtful object, but if we have our fingernails and our teeth, we can still harm ourselves if we want. I think for those who are parents out there, to be a parent, that is a very overwhelming and frustrating concept. That no one can make your child stop doing this. We can work with you on understanding that, and hopefully the therapist will help you understand that and work with you and your teen, but we can't make them stop. So why eating disorders and self-injury? Like I was introduced, I run both the eating disorder and the self-injury partial program. So my individuals are with us for the day. The eating disorder program is a 7-hour program. The self-injury program is a 6-hour program. They come with us during the day. We have group therapy, we have process groups, we have skills groups, we have family sessions, and then they go home at night. And hopefully what they're doing at night is practicing what they're learning and using it and then coming back in the next morning. And we're checking in to see how they managed, and then we're working on new skills. but between 25 to 40% of patients treating for eating disorders also have self-injury. So it's the reason why I'm in charge of both programs. We have a high overlap. Eating disorder diagnoses and level of care guidelines do not include the co-occurring self-injury. Our eating disorder environment community, many years, would just kind of brush the self-injury aside and just focus on the eating disorder because you're looking at malnutrition, you're looking at brain development. But the self-injury is very important to be able to monitor and work with as well. For both eating disorders and self-injury, there's some really similar underlying what's going on. Cognitive distortions, those are the thoughts that they're experiencing. Oftentimes we call it all or nothing thinking. If I didn't get an A, I'm a failure. If I don't do this, then that. So they really put a lot of pressure on themselves, and it's thinking in a way that's not accurate. It's a little bit distorted. I have to have everything always be perfect in order to be accepted by people. Or they do a lot of catastrophizing, meaning, oh my gosh, my mom texted me, I missed her text, and then kind of go off on a whole litany of things that could have happened that were wrong. Instead of waiting to find out what happened, kind of jumping to conclusions. And they can kind of get themselves spinning with their thoughts, and then because their thoughts are out of control, then they focus on their behaviors. Okay? Usually there's a lot of self-hatred and self-disgust. Their self-perception is usually quite distorted as well. They think very negatively of themselves. And working with these individuals for as many years as I have, these guys are such great individuals. Yes, they're struggling. Yes, they don't know how to manage right now, but they have such positive attributes to offer, and they don't see it. And what we try to work with them on is starting to recognize some of their positives. Oftentimes, eating disorder and self-injury are used as a way to manage, as I've said. When you restrict, when you binge, when you purge, when you injure yourself, what your body is doing is it's increasing its endorphins. There is a dopamine release, and the person's feeling this euphoric runner's high without ever having to lace up the tiny shoes and go running, right? So it's quick, it's easy in the moment. Right, 15, 20 minutes, they're feeling really good about themselves. They have a physiological response in their body. And then after that time is over, there's usually a lot of guilt and shame involved with what they've just done. So then we have to work with them on building that tolerance, dealing with those thoughts and feelings. Many use their self-injury and eating disorder as a way to punish themselves. I didn't do well enough. I messed up. I didn't share with that person the information I was supposed to share. Or sensory overload. There's so much going on in their world, they don't know how to handle it. So if I engage in these behaviors, it will decrease my feelings, and I will feel that state of calm, and then I can manage my thoughts and feelings better. Slide number 34 is what we have as our treatment model. And it looks like there's a lot of stuff going on, but basically what we're working on is self-regulation, how to manage our internal thoughts and feelings, how to manage our safety, including surrounding ourselves with others. You know, am I someone who struggles with substances, but I'm going to that party tonight where I know that people will be engaging in substances? Am I working on thinking better about myself, but I'm hanging around a friend that always calls me, you know, fat and lazy? So, and also our physical well-being. What am I doing to take care of myself? Am I taking care of my basic needs? Am I getting enough sleep? Am I trying to have fun? Am I being spiritual? Whatever it may be for that individual, right, working on that. Then working on the cognitive behavior of thoughts, I'm challenging our thoughts. Are my thoughts distorted? And then working on our systems. That oftentimes includes our family. You know, we don't live in a vacuum. So who around me, and how can I work with them? How can I learn to communicate to get my needs met? And am I hearing basically what everyone is telling me, or if I'm adding more information to it? So when working with the co-occurring of eating disorders and self-injury, we do a basic assessment, and we're asking a lot of personal questions, and it can be really overwhelming, and it's overwhelming for the family, it's overwhelming for the individual. But what we're trying to do is get a full idea of what is going on so that we can best help. And we're not trying to be nosy, we're not passing judgment, we're trying to get the most information, so how can we best help your loved one? And we look a lot at what's going on internally. What's going on emotional? Do we have a family history of major depression? Do we have some chemical issues going on? You know, external, how is our family? You know, have we had some recent deaths? Is there a job loss? You know, situational, have we just shifted schools? It's not unusual that we see a lot of girls come in between their, right after they just started their freshman year of college. You know, they're fearful that freshman 15 or 20 or whatever it is now, they don't want to do it and they try to diet and it gets out of control and it's situational and they're in college and they don't know how to manage. Right? So we look at all those different things and those different features, not to pry, but to try to get the best picture we can to help. One of the things that we work on then while they're with us and in it, those who have individual therapy, is where they're at with their treatment. We all feel overwhelmed. We all feel like there's days where we don't want to get out of bed. But are we looking at, you know, it's all my fault, it's always my fault, I can't do this? Kind of, you know, Winnie the Pooh characters, Eeyore. Or do we look at more of an active position of, you know what, this is tough right now, but I can do it. And we may be saying this is tough, but I can do it right now, but in an hour, we may be saying, I don't want to do this anymore. And that's part of the recovery, and it's part of what we work with the individuals so they can learn to understand where they're at. Because these guys are strong individuals. You know, they may look weak and frail, especially if they have some of the malnourishment, the decompensation going on with their bodies physically. But these guys are strong individuals. Okay, these guys aren't porcelain. They're not going to shatter. These people are strong individuals that have found a way to be able to manage whatever's going on in a way that they could help survive. Okay, so we want to work with them on giving them the power to take charge of their treatment in the sense that they can work on managing their thoughts. They can work on managing their belief system and work on changing it. It's not easy. It is difficult to do. Also what we have, I have a circle on page 38 with all different areas of assessment considerations. The literature has oftentimes blamed the parents and the family members, especially the moms. And, you know, we don't subscribe to that. I don't know about any of you. When I brought my son home from the hospital, I think I got a booklet on how to manage for the next 48 hours. Nowhere does it say, congratulations, when your child's 15, they're going to have an eating disorder and self-injury. So it's very overwhelming, and it's very much of as an area where there's a lot of guilt and shame. And I don't believe in parent bashing. I believe in working with the family to try to help. What can we do for your child? What can we do with the family system that can best meet the needs? And sometimes it's just what was working in the past isn't working anymore because they're at a different stage. So we look at all these different features of the genetics, emotional environment, the security, threat, safety, social learning. What are the resources that are available? Attributions, developmental level, and biology as we're working with your individual to make sure that we're getting the full picture. Because what we have found is that if we work with just the eating disorders and the eating disorder behavior is becoming more manageable, the self-injury is going to start going out of control. Or vice versa, if we work with the self-injury and that's monitored, if they haven't yet gotten to the point where they know all their healthy coping skills, then the eating disorder is going to get out of whack. Because what we've found, I do not know of any healthy coping skills that can give that immediate release that some of these great behaviors that they've come up with can do. I tease and I joke, maybe bungee jumping. I don't know if bungee jumping is considered healthy, but I do know that I can't do that here at the hospital. So next I have listed some categories of when the eating disorder and the self-injury occur. They both can overlap, but they oftentimes might serve separate functions. They may engage in both behaviors with similar frequency and severity, and oftentimes there's some body image issues going on, and they're often distorted. Right? So oftentimes we think that self-injury doesn't have body image issues, but they do. And our young ones report not liking themselves at all and feeling that if I change this about my body, you know, it doesn't really matter. And so we try to work with them on accepting who they are. If the eating disorder is primary, the self-injury oftentimes might serve as a punishment in eating disorder reasoning. I didn't follow my meal plan, or I engaged in that binge, so now I need to be punished. Right? when the self-injury is primary, the eating disorders might have a bonus function or serve as primarily a self-harm. If someone uses laxatives, it really hurts your stomach, right? So there's that punishing. There's that self-injury feature involved in that as well. Body image issues often are related to purpose and function. Can't tolerate being connected to the body or do not approve of our size, right? We're all focusing on these numbers. We now have double zeros out there, and many of our girls are not double zeros, and they feel that comparison and feel like they need to try to get to that point or do something to punish themselves because they're not. Some of the things that we work on here in our treatment center is the onset. Which came first, the self-injury or the eating disorder? And which one is more severe right now? So some of the things that you might be asked about are the frequency, the time, how long, how often. Or if the individual doesn't engage in the eating disorders or the self-injury, what would happen? And for some, that can be a thought that they just can't manage even thinking about. We often find that the eating disorder behaviors can be intentional, purposeful, and deliberate, right? But it might not be causing that tissue damage that the self-injury is causing. So eating disorders can reinforce the self-injury. The restricting can be a way to punish. The emptiness can be an ache in the stomach. Purging also can be a way to punish. I already mentioned the laxatives are painful. Binging, eating without enjoyment, okay? The scars. Having your bones sticking through or being really obese and being wearing baggy clothing might be a way to reinforce the self-injury of hiding who you are. On slide 44, I have pseudo-eating disorder, and that's when the ability to engage in self-injury has been reduced, as well as the frequency and severity. May look like an eating disorder in early onset, but they're able to indicate that it's really not. When you're managing and monitoring it, the clinician will see that it's more of disordered eating. It hasn't gotten into the point where we're having an eating disorder. So we're messing around with some of our food issues, but we're not quite there. We want to work with them so that hopefully we can prevent it going into a full-blown eating disorder. We also have a lot of the diabulimia, where individuals who are diabetic are using their insulin as a way to manipulate their sugar levels. And I also have a number of self-injurers who are using their insulin as a way to injure. So we oftentimes are aware of that. We monitor their using of their insulin so that we can see where they're at and making sure they're using that in a healthy fashion. So one of the things that we strongly recommend is that you assess and treat both self-injury and eating disorders simultaneously. As I mentioned before, if we're going to focus on one, the other one is going to increase, and vice versa. Work on if there's a primary of eating disorder or self-injury so that we can see how we can best help guide the treatment. Doesn't mean that it can't get changed as the treatment's going along. Always look at what the belief is for the purpose and function of the behaviors and their bodies. And I so believe it's important to work with the patient where they're at. If someone is really struggling and thinking they don't even have an eating disorder or self-injury is not a problem, then I can't go into full skills mode on how to change those behaviors because they're not even sure that there's a behavior yet. So I work with them where they're at, how we can best manage, how we can best understand, and use a lot of education at that point. Then we want to look at assess the purpose and function of behaviors in relation to body image, and then work on increasing the tolerance for being connected to the body and managing these feelings. Usually, and I'm putting in quotes, you can't see me, the bad things are done, they've passed, so how can we manage and deal with what's happened in the past so that we can move forward in the future? And that's one of the things that was really important, but we have to wait for the individual to be ready to deal with those as well. So we work in a lot of baby steps and gradually with the individual. All right, so I'm done. I'm right on the dot here, too, at 12:45 for me, so it's 1:45 for you all. Are we opening up for questions now?
Certainly. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. And for our first question, This session provided me with a better understanding of eating disorders and self-injury. Star 1 if you strongly agree. Star 2 if you agree. Star 3 disagree. Or star 4 strongly disagree. Again, this question is, this session provided me with a better understanding of eating disorders and self-injury. Star 1 for strongly agree. Star 2 for agree. Star 3 disagree. Or star 4 strongly disagree. And we'll pause for just a moment. And question 2. This session educated me on approaches used in treating eating disorders and self-injury. Star 1 if you strongly agree. Star 2 agree. Star 3 disagree. Star 4 strongly disagree. Again, this session educated me on approaches used in treating eating disorders and self-injury. Star 1 strongly agree. Star 2 agree. Star 3, disagree, or star 4, strongly disagree. Again, we'll pause for just a moment as you signal us. Okay, our next question is, overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Again, the question is, overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1, if you strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Again, we'll pause for just a moment. Our next question. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. Again, I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. We'll pause for just a moment. And our final survey question today. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. Star 4, other. Again, this question is, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, if I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. Or star 4, for other. At this time, we'll begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you're joining us today using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Also, if you pressed star 1 before, please press star 1 again to allow your signal to reach our equipment. After you have signaled, you'll be asked to record your name. This will be played into the conference, indicating your line is open to ask your question. Once again, press star 1 if you'd like to signal for a question. And we'll take the first question. And caller, please go ahead and provide your name. Again, caller, your line is open. Please go ahead and state your name and ask your question.
Kathy. I was wondering how often you see this type of behavior in an adult who has experienced multiple tragedies, such as multiple suicides in the course of a year.
Frequently. Both my programs are working with ages 12 on up, and while my average age is for self-injury is 16, my average age population for eating disorders is 20, I do see adults who struggle. Oftentimes the adults will report that back when they started injuring, they didn't know anybody else did it or they weren't aware of it, whereas the teens, it's very common culture focus for them nowadays, but we do have the adults who will struggle. They really have a hard time with the eating disorder, and they have a hard time with the self-injury and managing the multiple traumas or suicides and just the dysregulation, the other experiences in their world. We do see it frequently.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Once again, please press star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. Again, that's star 1 if you'd like to ask a question, please. We'll pause for a moment. And we'll take the next question. Caller, please go ahead with your question and state your name. Again, caller, your line is open. Please go ahead and state your name and ask a question.
This is Liz, and I just was wondering if you could speak to the use of food tracking tools and if that's something that people find helpful or more hurtful when they're trying to manage or recover from some disorders.
Good question, Liz. We have those individuals that we will work with them on tracking their food, try to have an idea of what their meals are looking like. But on the other hand, I have just as many that will find it really difficult because then they obsess. Or if they see everything that's put down, then they really feel overwhelmed and feel like they don't deserve or shouldn't eat anymore during the day. We work with them on an individual basis, and we also have dietitians be a very big part of our treatment team. And the dietitians will work with them on their meal plans and also on tracking on how they're managing with their food. So one individual, and even in my private practice, I have one that I will not have her track her food because it will be very detrimental to her, whereas another one, it's very helpful. So I'm not giving you a clear-cut answer, but it is based more on on the individual basis. We also here at the hospital do blind weigh-ins every morning, and it's just one area of us to be able to help track, too. But so, you know, and we're very self-reporting, so as part of our self-regulation model, they report if how they did the night before, if they engaged in behaviors, if they ate 100% of their meal plan or not. And we work with them on that because, you know, they need to figure out how to do this without us around, too. But we want to provide them with the support. So good. Some yes, some no.
Thank you.
Sure.
And we'll take the next question.
Esther Sear.
Did you ask your question? I didn't catch it.
Okay. My question was how to access the information online.
Okay.
I wasn't able to get...
onto the website?
Yes.
I know that...
I'll go ahead with that. This is
okay.
Kate from Cigna.
Thanks, Kate.
You can normally access it through the Cigna behavioral website.
Yes.
I believe the site is down today.
Okay, so that's
getting it fixed. So if you've been here before, yep, the usual place, it will be up as soon as the website is back online.
Okay. This is my first time. I've never been to one of these before.
Okay. So you'll want to go to www.cignabehavioral.com.
Okay, so there's no health?
Nope. The website is just cignabehavioral.com.
Okay. And then?
And there's a link that says visit our education and resource center.
Okay.
And one more link that says eating disorder education.
Okay, and then I can
find a whole wealth of information in there. So that's the eating disorder website once you've gotten that far.
Okay. That's all I needed to know.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we'll take the next question.
Teresa. Hi, this is Teresa. I have a quick question for you. Is it possible for an adult who has been struggling with anorexia since they were a child to ever really recover from anorexia?
Good question. One of the things that I've stopped doing is, and as a young clinician many years ago, kind of would see people come in and think, oh, they're really motivated, they're going to do okay, or this one's really struggling, I don't know how, you know, how they'll be able to manage it. And one of the things, I stopped doing that because every individual is so different. If you've had your eating disorder for more than half your life, it's going to be a lot harder. There is possibility. It is able to be done. And sometimes instead of looking at that all or nothing of complete recovering, maybe looking at what's okay, you know, they call it harm reduction. What would be appropriate? What would be helpful? Instead of saying all or nothing thinking, because then we kind of engage in their same thought process. But kind of establishing what are the goals, what are the realistic goals, and keep going at it in increments instead of coming up with that big, almighty, free from an eating disorder. I have seen people recover fully from eating disorders. It is possible. It all depends on that individual and the support system they have as well.
Thanks.
Is that helpful?
Great. It's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
And we'll take another question.
Nani?
And your question?
Caller, your line is open. Go ahead, please. Again, caller, your line is open. Go ahead with your question, please. Once again, your line has been opened. You can go ahead and ask your question. And there is no response from that participant, and that does conclude the question and answer session. I'll now turn the call back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
I want to thank everyone very much for attending and say a special thank you to Dr. Steyer for providing us all with such wonderful insights today. If anyone has specific questions about any of the therapies or types of treatment discussed today, please contact the eating disorder team by calling the phone number on the back of your insurance card. Also, please be sure to mark your calendars to join our next eating disorder awareness seminar next month. It'll be on Tuesday, October 23rd. At 1 p.m. Eastern Time, that's noon Central and 10 Pacific. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation today.